This is Grant Leboff, author of Myths of Marketing, Banish the Misconceptions and Become a Great Marketer, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I produce this podcast to help us both keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow faster by taking a sales-based approach to marketing. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. And if you're one of the many, many listeners who's left a review on Apple Podcasts, I want to drop a little something in the mail to thank you. Details after the interview. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Grant Leboff to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, Myths of Marketing, Banish the Misconceptions and Become a Great Marketer, published by Kogan Page. Grant Leboff is one of the UK's leading sales and marketing experts. Continually challenging received wisdom, Grant built a successful direct marketing company in 2002 and sold it 6 years later. He now serves as a non-executive director and also runs a sales and marketing consultancy, Sticky Marketing Club, that advises clients on sales and marketing strategies to thrive in an increasingly competitive world. A regular speaker at conferences around the world, Grant Leboff is also a contributor to many business magazines and newspapers, including The Daily Telegraph, The Independent, and The Financial Times. He has appeared on BBC Radio on numerous occasions, as well as being featured on a significant number of U.S. radio networks. Grant is also the author of four other books, including Digital Selling, Sticky Marketing, and Stickier Marketing. And interesting fact, before marketing, Grant worked in the music industry as a producer, writer, and arranger. Grant, congratulations on Myths of Marketing, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Douglas. Thank you.
So it comes as no surprise to me that you worked in the music industry as a producer, writer, and arranger, because I happen to know that you live in Bushey, which is in the Watford area for those in the UK. And there are a lot of people from that little town who've made it big in the music industry, such as the founders of the pop music duo Wham, George Michael and Andrew Ridgely.
Wake me up before you go, go. Don't leave me hanging on like a yo-yo.
They're both graduates of Bushey Meads School, for those playing the home game. And also Simon Le Bon from Duran Duran. Born in Bushey. Did you know that? Are these some of your people?
Yeah, I'm amazed. You're absolutely right. In fact, they went to the Wham boys went to different schools. Right, I mean, literally 2-3 minutes from where I live. So you're absolutely right. Yeah. I'm surprised you knew that, but I'm impressed.
Well, you know, when you're the Marketing Book Podcast host, you get to read all of these books, and people would think that I'd learned a lot and I was really smart. And that's not really true. Instead, my mental hard drive is clogged with information like I just shared with you and the listener. But now whenever I hear music from Wham or Duran Duran, you know, Grant Leboff, you've positioned yourself right in there. And we're going to talk about positioning at one point. So, Grant, I love these new books from Kogan Page. I recently interviewed Michelle Carville about her book, Myths of Social Media, and I just I loved it, and I loved this book. This is exceptionally well written, and I love, I mean, even the little things like how you included the notes at the end of each chapter rather than at the end of the book, because when you're a book nerd like me, you'll put a footnote on there, and then I want to go see, oh, have I read that? Or, you know, I'm going to steal that information. So it was really, really, really well sourced. So there are 26 myths in your book, and I believe Michelle had 28 in hers. So tell us, how did you go about identifying the 26 that ended up in your book, and as well as how to order them?
That's a great question. So in terms of the way I started, so when Kogan Page, as you said in your introduction, I've written other books of Kogan Page, and when they sort of spoke to me about doing this book, for me, it was like, this sounds great, because it was all of those things that really irritate me.
Yes, about what yes. Same thing. I had that reaction as a listener. I was taking crazy pills. It was like, oh, this is turning into a support group. I have to explain this one every week.
Exactly right. So exactly right what you're saying. So there were things that, you know, everything that I want to get my soapbox for when people say things and it's like, well, that's not right, or that's not true, or, well, I don't think that. So I started with that, and I made that list. And if my memory serves me correct, that took me pretty much – you know, to where I needed to be in terms of the number of myths.
Came up with 75, like in the first 10 minutes.
And then it was just a question of, well, actually, what's going to be useful? What's going to be useful for the reader, and what's me just, you know, enjoying myself kind of thing? Because I want to enjoy myself, but I want to make sure that the reader enjoys it too, and gets something out of reading the book. And so it was edited back. And there were a couple that, As I was starting to write, I don't know if you find this, but when you start to write, you suddenly think, oh, hold on a minute, I need to address that issue as well. But that's a separate myth. So then I'd introduce that as well. And then in terms of the ordering, that was quite difficult, because in some ways, every myth is self-contained, as you know. But so it was just a question of trying to take the reader on a journey that kind of made sense.
Yes. And there were a few that were clearly related, which we can talk about. But yeah, I can see how you started it. And then you even ended with some controversy, which we're going to talk about. I thought I was the only person that thought what you say about in Myth 26. But let me, I picked three that were my favorite. I mean, the three that just really got me fired up. And well, let me put it this way, Grant Leboff. These are the three where more ink was marked up from the way you wrote things that I'm going to steal. So my favorite three were number 11, business to business purchases are purely based on logic.
Yeah.
Number 19, the focus of marketing communications should be a company's products or services. And myth 22, I instinctively understand my customer. Oh my goodness. And I have written about these things, and I have banged my head against the wall time and time, and I probably always will as long as I'm working. So I want to talk about those three and a few others from the book as time permits, but I wanted to read one excerpt from the preface. In this climate, what we need are genuine answers to questions such as, how has digital technology really impacted the nature of communications? What is the real difference between sales and marketing? Why is word of mouth not just happenstance, but a bona fide marketing channel? Myths of Marketing is written to cut through the misinformation and provide reasoned and researched answers to some of today's most important questions. From understanding that marketing is not contained in a single department, to recognizing how different price perceptions can affect your value proposition and understanding the importance of market positioning, Myths of Marketing will arm you with the insights you need in order to be effective. If you are ready to banish the misconceptions and become a great marketer, then Myths of Marketing might just be the book for you. So before we get into some of these myths, Grant, do you think there are more marketing myths now than in the recent past?
Yes, I do. But I'll qualify my answer to that. The reason why I think there are, and I'll try and be diplomatic here, Douglas, if I can, is because I think there are more people who regard themselves as marketers today that don't really understand marketing at all. And what I mean by that is there's a whole plethora of, if I say, social media experts who actually call themselves marketers because they slightly misunderstand what marketing is. And then they are really, you know, flouting their experts on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or Snapchat or whatever platform it is. And therefore, there are an awful lot of people that are in the marketing space who really don't understand the fundamentals of marketing, but happen to understand the workings of a particular channel quite well. And therefore, what then tends to happen, of course, is because they regard themselves as marketers and they're talking about marketing as if they're authorities on it, I think that then perpetuates the situation where you've got more and more myths sort of being invented and created and being spoken about, which are simply, you know, not true. So that's why I think it happens. But I do think there are, yes.
Well, this wraps up today's episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. Grant, I couldn't agree with you anymore. And I think that it's very true. And it makes it even more difficult for marketers. And it contributes to this perception that so many people have of marketers, what I call civilians, meaning people not in a marketing department. The charlatan meter has gone way up in recent years. I agree completely. And I think it's just that much more difficult for marketers to get some traction and show what's possible. So let's talk about, we want to go in kind of order here, but number one is one I've run into, particularly with like maybe a CEO or somebody who hasn't done marketing or sales for a long time, and they just remember what worked for them 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then this chapter then gets into a lot of the things that I find myself having to explain over and over, and which is myth number one, marketing communications haven't fundamentally changed. It just hasn't changed. But you show very clearly how it has changed. So I'm guessing that since this was number one, you run into this a lot. Talk to us about how it has changed in hopes that a lot of the people listening can then try to spread that word.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting question. And I always think fundamentally the big change in marketing over the last 20 years or so, and it's evolved as you well know, is that for the first time in history, we live in a world where everybody has a media channel. Mm-hmm. And that fundamentally changes everything, because in the old days, it's actually frightening to think about where we were sort of 20, 25 years ago, that really and truly, those people that had control of information distribution were relatively small. You know, it was a small number of TV broadcasters, radio broadcasters, newspaper conglomerates, etc., that had the control of information. But with the creation of the World Wide Web and social media and smartphone technology, we now live in a world where every business has its own media channels, be that its website, its YouTube channel, its Facebook page, its LinkedIn page, etc., whatever other channels it chooses to use. And then, of course, every individual, over 4 billion now on planet Earth, have their own media channel as well. And that changes a number of things. Number one, it means that we live in a world of information overload, of information abundance, because in theory, everybody now has their own media outlet, and abundance of information leads to scarcity of attention. So we now live in a world where I believe that attention is the most precious resource on planet Earth.
Agreed.
So that's one fundamental change. But the other fundamental change is that when you get into digital channels and you are a business or an organization, marketing used to be the art of interrupting someone else's audience. You know, whether you put an advert in a newspaper or an advert in a magazine or an advert on television or whatever it was, essentially you were interrupting the audience that belonged to the media business that had cultivated their readership or their viewers. Today, when you've got your own media channels, from a strategic perspective, you want to build an audience and retain it, because that's how media works fundamentally. And in a world where attention is the most precious resource on planet Earth, building audience and retaining it is a really smart thing to do. You know, if you sent a direct mail 30 years ago and you got a 1% response rate or a 2% response rate, what did you do with the other 98%? Well, there was nothing you really could do. But today, actually, you can, you know, cost effectively engage with thousands, potentially millions of prospects. And it doesn't cost you any more because it's a fixed cost. You know, someone, if I make a video on YouTube, it doesn't cost me any more whether 5 people watch it or 5 million people watch it. And of course, actually, it's more cost effective if 5 million people watch it, assuming they're the right target market for me. So I think in these sort of fundamental ways, communications is quite different from where it was 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, moving on, there's a talk I've given in the past, you know, that I sort of have in my bag of tricks, and one of them is about sort of like what a CEO needs to know about marketing. Because I had a friend who became a CEO, and he called me up and said, "Doug, what's going on here? What am I supposed to do? What are these people supposed to be doing?" And I basically explained it to him in about 45 minutes, and he said, "Okay, I got it." And I'll give a talk like to manufacturers or industrial companies, and they love to, some of them love to say, "Oh, we never do marketing. We've grown this thing without doing any marketing." And so as a result of hearing that over the years, I've had to include this notion of, well, you have been doing marketing, you just don't realize it. And that's why we're not going to go through every one of these, but I did want to talk about myth number two, and that is that marketing is just communications, you know, which makes me, I had this idea when I was reading this, is like, you know, a lot of marketing departments, for better or worse, as we've discussed, are basically noise-making departments. And I think people will understand that after you explain, remind folks what marketing is. And if you could, maybe reference the four Ps as well as your more modern acronym of CAVE. I loved it.
Yeah, thank you. So yeah, very interesting. So you're right. And what's disturbing, actually, Douglas, I think, is that so many marketing people seem to think that marketing is just communication.
Yes, and I think that's even worse.
Agreed, which is kind of worrying. So marketing, as I defined it in the book, is the process of determining, communicating, and delivering value in order to obtain and retain customers. And, you know, determining value is determining what you actually sell in the first place, your value proposition, if you like, and the scope of that value proposition. And as you absolutely said, every business owner in the world has done marketing because they've defined what their business does and what they sell or what they offer. So clearly that is marketing. Where people get confused is they say, well, that's not really marketing, is it? It's business strategy. And to which I always reply, well, it's both, because marketing is a strategic discipline. So most of marketing is strategic by its very definition. So determining value is partly marketing. Communicating is the bit that, of course, everybody knows. Although I always say you can't communicate if you've got nothing to say. So you've got to start off by understanding what the offer is.
Right. And it's like the idea of there was a reason the fourth P, which we'll talk about, it was promotion. You don't really want to do that until you get the first three out of the way.
Yeah, exactly right. And then, of course, delivering value is determining, you know, exactly how people receive that value. Do you go through distribution? Do you go in retail? Do you send purely online? Is it a face-to-face offering? Is it a hybrid offering? You know, explaining how people access that value, understanding how they receive that value is, again, a marketing decision. And of course, value itself, it doesn't exist in a vacuum, because you know, if I charge you $1 million for something or $500 for something, that changes your value perception. So pricing obviously necessarily becomes part of that value matrix as well. So all of those things encompass marketing, which is reflected in the four P's, which we all know, I'm sure most of your listeners know, is product, place, price, promotion. So product is what you offer. Place is where it's accessed. Price is what you charge. And then promotion is how people find out about it. And I struggle with those four P's because I think they're slightly outmoded today. And so I changed them to an acronym called CAVE, which I obviously can explain.
Please do. I think the four P's for me brings to mind an era of different supply and demand when yes. there was much greater demand than supply and they could be a little more autocratic. Now there's almost infinite choice that customers have.
Agreed. We agree with each other on that. So my acronym CAVE, and I'll explain what it replaces in the four P's. So C stands for communication, which replaces promotion. And the reason why I say that is because promotion really smacks of kind of traditional advertising. Buy this here, and this is what you get, and these are the benefits. But so much of the communication we do today, which goes back to myth one, which is because we own media channels today, is not purely promotional at all. In fact, a media channel, no one's going to visit your website if all your website does is say, we're amazing and this is why. If your website can give people real value, real insights, tips, hints, ideas, suggestions, really give value to the audience, then people want to come back. They may want to sign up for a newsletter. They may want to go and watch your videos, whatever it is. And so I think promotion isn't wrong. It's just too one-dimensional. I think communication allows you to start thinking in terms of content creation and utilizing media in a bigger way. And that's why communication replaces promotion. We've then got access, which is the second part of CAVE. And access replaces place. So access, the reason why is because, you know, traditionally there was a place. You went to a store, or even if it was my office, you went to somewhere to access the offer. But of course, today we live in a world where there are access points all over the place. You know, the websites and all sorts of hybrid offerings as well. Think about retail where you've got click and collect and these kind of multi-purpose access points. And therefore, I think place, again, is just too one-dimensional way of thinking about it. I think you should think in terms of accessibility and convenience, and that's why we replace place with access. Then, of course, we've got value, and value replaces price, because, again, I think price is too one-dimensional. I think that value is all-encompassing, because value isn't just about what you charge, but also the effort that someone has to put in. I mean, you know, people always talk about free. Oh, you can go on my website and access free content. But of course, free content isn't free because it takes my time. And I would argue that my time is a more precious resource than my money. And therefore, there's got to be a value exchange. If you want me to come onto your website and access your free content, then I've got to get something out of that. But that's not about price. It's about value. So I think value is a better way of thinking about the exchanges that we have. Sometimes that will mean someone actually hands over money, as it were. Sometimes it might be they give up some time or invest something else of themselves. So that's why we think about value. And the last one is experience. And experience replaces product. And I think it's because, you know, we've gone from a product economy to the service economy, but now we're really in an experience economy. You know, we've gone beyond just services, where the entire experience, the engagement with you, the conversations with you, the value add that you give changes everything. And I think to think in terms of things in terms of product or even in terms of services limits your thinking. If we talk about experiences, how we involve the customer, how we want the customer to feel, I think we start to get into a very different space. And therefore, I think CAVE, people can see where it's replaced the four P's, but I just think it's a more expansive way of thinking about what we do today.
Yes, I like it. It works really well. And also, you touched on myth 20 right there, which we were going to talk about, but thanks, Grant. Now we can skip that. No, we are operating in a service economy. And so I got to that chapter, we are operating in a service economy. And I thought, that seems like a rather benign and obvious thing that's true. Boy, was I mistaken. you touched on it just then. We're actually going beyond the service economy, and you've got this whole brilliant chapter on we're in the experience economy now. So again, that's one of those things where that's one of the most important things that I talk about sometimes when I say, what are those repeating things? What are the most important things from so many books? And one of them is about how your experience, the way your customers, how you make them feel is really your most important marketing. And then there's lots of examples of companies that are very proactively engineering that. But let's get back to these damn marketers, shall we?
Absolutely.
Don't worry, they're not listening anymore. It's just you and me at this point, Grant. But that was that number six. This myth ties in very nicely what we were just talking about. Marketing is solely the responsibility of the marketing department, which of course brought to mind every great quote that I've ever read in a book about some of these really big things, like from Philip Kotler or Peter Drucker or David Packard, where he said marketing is too important to be left to the marketing department. Can you talk? I mean, after reading this, it becomes abundantly clear, I think, for somebody that's not even familiar with this, which is why it's preposterous to think that the marketing department is responsible for all marketing. And I think there are a lot of listeners who are going to say, yeah, I understand what marketing is. And no, I'm not responsible for all things that go into marketing. Talk about the rub there.
Yeah. So what's really interesting is not only is marketing not the sole responsibility of the marketing department, I would actually argue that most strategic marketing is not even done in the marketing department because, most people, when they think about innovation, when they think about their value proposition, when they think about evolving marketplaces and how they're going to stay current and culturally relevant, most of these conversations should be happening at board level. Now, of course, there can well be a CMO who is part of that conversation, but they're not solely making those decisions on their own, behind some door which says marketing, and they go back to the board and say, right, this is our value proposition. This is how I think the market's changing. So this is what we're doing next. Everybody's the CEO and other people senior in the organization are going to have a view on that. So I absolutely think that, a lot of the marketing is not done in the marketing department. In fact, most of what's done in the marketing department, which goes back to the other myth, is the comms. The tactical communications is often sort of delivered by the marketing department.
The noise making.
Exactly right, which is absolutely fine. But most of the business and marketing strategy is done at board level, at the executive level. And sure, in my opinion, if you've got a good CMO, they should definitely be part of that conversation and can certainly add something to that conversation. We'll have another perspective, as will the CFO, as will the CEO, as will the COO. But, the idea that marketing takes place behind a door called marketing, kind of in a vacuum on its own, is ridiculous. And then, of course, you can go further and say that actually delivering the customer experience and your customer experience managers and people on the shop floor, if that's relevant for your business, all of these things contribute to the overall impression that people have of that business. And that affects the value that people perceive they get and whether you're going to get repeat purchases. And so marketing is so much bigger than one department. And I think the world would be a better place if people understood how they contribute to the whole overall experience that customers receive. But, one of the things that always makes me kind of irritable, I suppose, is that, we talk about Peter Drucker. Peter Drucker famously said the purpose of business is to create a customer, which of course 100% right. But how many businesses do we all know where they seem to be doing everything but trying to create a customer? In fact, if anything, they seem to be rather than make you customer centric and then make the whole experience for the customer magical and, want you to come back and want you to get involved. And so, putting marketing in a department actually, I think, limits the creativity of an organization, the ability to win and keep customers, which is, after all, what they're in business to do.
So, Grant Leboff, I have to ask then, why should we even have a marketing department?
Yeah, So that's a great question.
For all those CEOs listening right now thinking, you know what, I was going to let that department go anyway. Don't do it. Put the gun down. No, go ahead.
So I actually think that today, and you've got to be very careful with language, because I think sometimes you can get a bit almost sort of, you know, so sort of bogged down in the detail that you lose the bigger picture. So we can call it marketing and people know what that means. But I think the value of a marketing department today is to look at the world through the customer's eyes.
Amen.
Because operations, obviously, you know, if you're the COO, you're looking at the operation. What's it costing you? How can you make it more efficient? How can you streamline it? How can you do things better? The chief financial officer is looking at finance, and they're looking at it through spreadsheets and, you know, what's our cost base and how do we make sure we're competitive? And so everybody's looking at a business and an organization through their own eyes. And therefore you say, well, what should marketing be looking at it through? The eyes of the customer. Someone has to be a champion of the customer in today's world, especially in today's world where customers, let's be honest, have so much choice. You know, if they're not using your business, there's probably loads of other suppliers they could go to instead. And therefore, I think the value of a marketing department today, and, you know, we can call it something else if we want. You know, I allude to in the book and say it should be a chief customer officer, really. Yeah. But you know, I'm not so worried about the language, but the marketer's job is to look at the world through the customer's eyes and represent customers at the board's level. And actually, that is a vital job, because if marketing's not doing it, no one else is. And that's when, you know, companies can lose their way, because ultimately the purpose of business, as Peter Drucker said, is to create customers.
Yes. And a quick story comes to mind. There was a listener in New Zealand years ago, and he had worked in marketing in the past, and he did some other things, and then he wanted to get back into marketing, and he had been listening to a lot of the Marketing Book podcast episodes, and he contacted me one day and introduced himself on LinkedIn and said, hey, I've been listening to your podcast a lot, and I've been interviewing for this job, and I've learned a lot on your show, and you know, I think I might actually get this job. And I was pleased, and you know, I'm sure he could have gotten the job without listening to my podcast, but he later contacted me and said, hey, I got that job. And can you recommend, it was some sort of business to business tech, water filtration, something very technical. And he says, are there any books you could recommend? Because a lot of listeners ask me for book recommendations. And I said, well, I don't know about any about water filtration or whatever that line of work they were in. I said, I'm sure there might be one there. But what I said was, you know, there are a lot of engineers and probably scientists working there who will probably forget more about that particular field than you will ever learn. What you might want to do is become the expert on your customers. And I gave him examples. I gave him a couple books to go read. Well, lo and behold, a few months later, he contacted me and said, my goodness, it worked. I'm the expert on the customer here. I'm invited to all the meetings now. I have a seat at the table, and everyone, even all those experts, they quiet down when I start explaining the mindset of the customer. So I was very pleased to hear that. And it really does work. And that's why, yeah, maybe they call him the customer department or the chief customer officer or something like that. Moving on, let's talk about number five, which was, I don't need a marketing plan. I just tried to say that with an American accent. I don't need no stinking marketing plan. It brought to mind a quote from General and later President Eisenhower. He said, you know, plans are useless, but planning is invaluable. And he was quite the planner. So you write, a marketing plan forces a business to think through the necessary strategic issues, which will provide it with a much greater chance of success. Can you explain what it is that marketing plan does in terms of forcing that kind of thought?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, you know, marketing is a strategic discipline, and too many people get so focused on the tactics, they forget about the strategy, and tactics are useless if you don't have a strategy that you're working against. You know, people worry about where they're going to advertise, you know, which social media channel is going to be most appropriate for them, you know, whether they got their pay-per-click strategy right, all of these different things. And there's value in all of that. But unless you've got a strategy, you understand your positioning in the marketplace, your competitive advantage, how your offering fits, who it's right for, who the target market's going to be, why they should buy from you. Unless you've got all of those kind of things lined up and ready to go, then to be honest, all the tactics in the world are not going to make any difference. And, you know, I've consulted for thousands of different companies, and over the years, you know, marketing rarely goes wrong because somebody's tactical execution was inept. Marketing tends to go wrong because the strategy was, you know, it was just useless, or there was no strategy. And so, you know, it really matters to think about your strategy. And then I put in the book a few sort of models which people will know, things like Steeple, which is a variation on the PEST test, which was, you know, the Harvard professors, Francis Aguilar, put together in the 60s. But, you know, if you just take Steeple and you think about Steeple, it makes you think about your offering against social changes, technological changes, economic ones, political ones, legal ones, ethical ones. And, you know, you can see all of those things going on. You know, I always say to people, there's no such thing as a culturally irrelevant brand. You know, it's an oxymoron. You know, it's a contradiction in terms. You know, for a brand to be successful, it has to be culturally relevant. So as, you know, culture changes, unless you pivot your brand, you're going to lose your market. And, you know, we see that all the time. You know, there's a great example at the moment, which I'm sure a lot of marketers are watching with fascination. I certainly am, which is Gillette, which, you know, as we know, is the world's biggest men's razor. And, you know, their alpha male strap line, the best a man can get, has served them well for decades. But we're living in a world now where that sort of alpha male stereotype is becoming less and less culturally relevant. And unless Gillette kind of starts to evolve out of that, they're going to start to lose market share, which is a terribly scary thing for them to have to change, because obviously it's been so successful for so long. But they are changing it. They are evolving it very, very slowly, as I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of. But, you know, this is a classic example of a brand, of a business that understands that the social norms are changing. But that's a strategic issue and a strategic understanding. If you just, you know, if all Gillette focus on is where their latest TV campaign is going to be a good one, eventually they're going to lose their market share, because it's the strategic issues that will kill them, not the tactical execution.
And so it's almost like what you need is marketing planning on an ongoing basis, and don't obsess so much over the plan, because the plan is going to fall out of that process. So yeah, I think there's this, again, an unhelpful image of marketing plans as being these really dazzling, beautiful things that ultimately collect a lot of dust, and people feel like they've checked a box. So moving on, let's go to another one, which is going to be super relevant to every single person listening who works in sales. Quick story. Just as this pandemic was starting to get real in, at least in the United States, in March, I recall the National Basketball Association said, we're not going to keep playing. And Major League Baseball said, that's it. I was like, oh, maybe this is really a thing. So, of course, naturally, I continued off doing what I was doing. And I went with this friend of mine named Mike, and he's a sales consultant, and he helps companies turn around their sales and by hiring the right kind of people and getting all that in place. Well, this one company, this industrial company, was going to need a lot of help with some, you know, I guess in air quotes, more marketing types of things. And so he brought me to one of the first meetings, and we sat down with the owner. And basically, Grant Liboff, he's not going to be reading this book, I'm pretty sure. And he couldn't understand why he needed more than the 2-page website they had. And he was kind of flummoxed as to why Mike would even bring this marketing guy into the meeting. And basically, most of the conversation was, look, as long as I got the lowest price, That's how I'm going to grow it. That's how this is going to work, and we're going to produce this. And so I said, well, okay. I after a while, you know when to fold them. And I wasn't there to pitch them. I was there to see if we could help. I got back in the car with my friend Mike, and I said, Mike, brother, you got your work cut out with this client if they think all they have to do is compete on price. So myth number 7 is ultimately people buy on price. Grant Liboff, why is that a myth?
Yeah, well, gosh. So it's really interesting. So I used to train salespeople. And inevitably, in any sales training, at some point, a salesperson will tell you that their hands are tied, they can't do anything because actually all customers care about is price. And I used to do exactly the same exercise. I knew I was going to get it every time. So when I got it, I used to say to the sales guys, I used to say to everybody in the room, right, everybody put down their pens and, you know, let's go outside. And I want everybody to go into the car park and have a look at what cars are in the car park and then come back and tell me. And of course, they look very confused. They were like, you know, what is this guy doing? So, you know, they'd all go out.
And they were probably suspicious because of your music industry background anyway.
Well, of course. It goes without saying. So they went into the car park. They looked around. They'd come back. And I'd say, so, you know, what did you see? And someone would put their hand up. So I saw a BMW. I saw a Mercedes. I saw a Volvo. I saw this. I saw, you know, and we get all the different brands of cars. And then I'd say, well, I don't understand. You told me people buy on price. And they'd look at me confused and they'd say, what's one thing got to do the other? And I said, well, if people buy on price, surely there should only be one car park, you know, one car in the car park. And that's the cheapest. There shouldn't be any other cars, right? Because everybody buys on price. And of course, then they got it. And, you know, it's just a ridiculous idea that people buy on price. Price is a criteria of purchase. That's all it is. And there are lots of others. You know, again, you know, you go into remember pre-COVID, we used to be able to fly, but, you know, you go into an aeroplane and, of course, there's first class and there's business class and there's premium and there's economy. And it's like, well, surely if people buy on price, there should only be economy. There shouldn't be any other class of because people are only going to buy the cheapest one. But, of course, it's not true. You know, people buy on a number of different criteria, and price is only one of them. And actually, the idea that you compete on price is a race to the bottom, because someone can always undercut you, whoever they are. So actually, I would say not only is price not the main criteria by which you should compete, it's also the most dangerous criteria by which you compete, because there's however cheap you are, there's someone's going to come along and they're going to undercut you. And at that point, your customers will leave and they go somewhere else if the only value you were giving them was price. So not only do I think that price clearly isn't the only criteria of purchase, it's also the most ridiculous one to compete on, because it's the one that's easiest for someone else to kind of cut your legs off and take your market share away.
Yes, it's probably like playing Russian roulette. You're not going to be playing that very long. And in that chapter, you is a great summary of all the things that people do buy on. And yeah. There was another book on the show a couple of years ago by John Asher called Close Deals Faster, I think it was. And he had an excellent part in the same thing about how a lot of salespeople will think, we've got to get a lower price. But he went back and did all this research and found other research that talked about how there are so many other things that are much more important than price, such as the reputation of the buyer and the implications of making the wrong purchase. So it was a great summary there. So chapter 11, as I mentioned, myth 11 was one of my three favorites, and that is business-to-business purchases are purely based on logic. This chapter was such a wonderful annihilation of that concept. And I've long argued, I remember reading an article in Gallup that touched on this a few years ago, but not in the depth of your chapter and all your endnotes. Explain why, or perhaps make the case why B2B purchases are actually much more emotional than an individual's B2C purchase.
Yeah, it's a great point. So I'll try and do this briefly, because as you know from reading the book, it's an involved topic. But essentially, human beings have two systems of thinking, system one and system two. System one is the subconscious, which people often think is the emotional mind. And system two is the conscious, which people often think of as the rational mind. And you won't find a credible behavioral psychologist anywhere in the world that will tell you that system one accounts for less than about 90% of the decision-making process. So 90 to 95% of everything that we do happens in our subconscious, which isn't the rational, it's the emotional. And therefore, as I always say to people, people don't change. Human beings don't change because they put on a suit and go to work. You know, our physiology is exactly the same whether we're at work or we're at home. So the idea that when we get to business, we all become sort of Spock from Star Trek and everything becomes completely rational and logical is just patently ridiculous, because the suggestion would be that our physiology changes because we went to work that day, which obviously isn't true. To go to your point, though, which I think is lost on a lot of people, is that actually business-to-business purchases in the main are more emotional, not less emotional, and the reason why is simply risk. So, you know, if I go to the store to buy myself a candy bar, right, you know, or I go to the supermarket and try a new brand of cookies or pretzels or something, you know, if I get it wrong, who cares? The ramifications of it are so small. Even things that people really care about, like a pair of trainers, you know, I go to the store and I buy a new pair of trainers and, you know, I get them home and they didn't work out. They weren't as comfortable as I thought. I get a few blisters on my feet and in the end, I end up throwing them away and buying a new pair. It's a pain. And, you know, we get upset if you spent a few hundred dollars on a good pair of trainers and it didn't work out for you. But the ramifications of that decision for most people are fairly small. And therefore, we don't lose much sleep over it. Whereas now take business. I'm using a law firm to handle a really difficult patent case. Or I'm investing in some enterprise level software, which I think is going to revolutionize my customer experience and give me real competitive advantage. If I screw that up, the ramifications for me personally in terms of my respect against my fellow employees, in terms of where my company ends up, in terms of meeting its targets, reporting its targets to the city. I mean, these are major, major ramifications.
And your future earnings potential.
Exactly.
And your career's at stake.
Emotionally, it's huge. And therefore, the emotions might be different. You know, Coca-Cola sell happiness in a can. I'm not sure, you know, Oracle are selling happiness. But the thought that they're not selling an emotion is just ridiculous, whether it's reassurance or confidence or aspiration or, you know, whatever else it is. But it's emotion in spades. And therefore, not only is business to business purchases emotional, you could make a very good case for saying in the main, they are more emotional than any purchases we make as consumers.
So true. So true. And like even right now, I live in a 110-year-old house and it's got a slate roof, which lasts, those last 150 years or whatever. But I've actually got to get some repairs done to it. And even if I hire the wrong slate roofing company, that's still less emotional than if I make the wrong decision for my company because I'm just out the money. You know, like let's say you buy a bad car. Well, that's on you. But that doesn't mean that your future earnings and the viability of your company are not at stake. So I wanted to get to another one that was just one of my favorites. And part of the reason is there was a presentation I gave once. I've given it a couple times to manufacturing groups of all things. And it was called Stop Talking About Your Product First. And the first time I pitched that, it was at a manufacturing event. And I thought they were going to say, no, you have no place amongst manufacturers of products. And then they said, yes, please come speak. Then I thought I was going to get thrown off the stage. There were like 250 people there, but they were very, very interested. So let's talk about number 19. The focus of marketing communications should be a company's products or services. You talk at the beginning of that chapter about hitchhiking, which in my misspent youth, yes, I did do some hitchhiking. And you talk about that at the beginning of the chapter, and it had some double meaning. But why should a company, well, let me put it this way. What are the perils of a company talking about their products and services at the expense of maybe the issues or problems that their customers might have?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So the analogy I gave at the beginning of the myth was the hitchhiker that, you know, the hitchhiker pulls the car over and the car driver winds down the window and starts talking about, you know, the reliability of the vehicle, how good the vehicle is, the wonderful music that he's decided to play on the journey. And he starts relaying all the different, you know, different types of music that he's got for different parts of the journey, and how he's a safe driver, never had an accident. And of course, all the hitchhiker's thinking while this guy's talking and talking is, where are you going? I don't care. Because if I don't know where you're, if you're not going where I'm going, the rest of this is completely irrelevant. And actually, that's one of the biggest issues. You know, you'll be irrelevant. Because and this pains a lot of people, I think. And I've had this experience many times. And I say this myself as a marketing consultant, you know, and I normally use myself as the example, because that way I don't offend anybody else. But I would say no one cares about what you do. They only care about what it means to them. And I normally say to my audience, you don't care about marketing, and you don't care if I'm any good. All you care about today is, did you get any hints, tips, insights, and ideas from me that are going to make your business better? If the answer is yes, that was a great 45 minutes spent. If the answer is no, it was a waste of your time. And you don't care about me, and people don't care about you as your business. They care about what your business does and what it means to them. And if you don't understand that it's all about what it means to them, you're absolutely going to lose the customer on the first, you know, sentence of your website, or the first, you know, iteration of your advert, or whatever it is. It's all about the customer. And it's got to be about the customer, because that's what they care about, and rightly so. And you see it all the time. You see people get it all wrong. They talk about, you know, how great their services are, how great their products are, what they do, and the customer doesn't care. The customer all they care about is, what does it mean for them? And I have a mantra which I use all the time. It's actually painted down my boardroom, so you can't have a meeting in my office without seeing this mantra. And the mantra is, make your customer the hero.
Yes.
Make your customer the hero. Make it all about them. Don't make it about you.
Amen. That is so true. And I know we're running a little long, but I just wanted to read this one quote from that myth. If a business focuses its communications on its products or services, it is unlikely to create material that connects emotionally with prospects. Failure to achieve this makes it less likely that its marketing will be shared. This means missing out on one of the most effective routes to market available today. Without focusing on creating value, it is unlikely that any communications will truly engage prospects. Marketing is now a product in its own right. Consequently, merely describing products and services together with their benefits is likely to miss the mark in this digital age. And I could go on, because the paragraph after that's even better, but Grant Leboff, you've probably already heard that. And I just want to disagree with you about one thing. When you say you don't care about me, Grant Leboff, I care about you. Okay.
That's very kind of you, Douglas.
Don't you ever forget that. Okay. The last one I wanted to talk about that was of my three favorites was number two. I instinctively understand my customer. Talk about why it is so important to truly understand one's customers, why it is so difficult for companies to understand their customers, and what are some of the things that companies could be doing to try to better and to better understand them? And you even included something that should disarm them, where you say, don't ask them what they want. I've actually sat in focus groups years ago when I worked in the agency world in New York, where some ill-trained focus group moderator was saying, I got to tell the client, you know, what you guys want. I hope they're not still leading focus groups. Was it Henry Ford who allegedly said, if I'd asked people what they wanted, they would have asked for a faster horse that ate less,
exactly,
or something like that? And then you had one, understanding the customers. It seems to me like those companies that best understand their customers ultimately win.
Yeah, 100%. So one of my favorite things to say to people, because it's very disarming, especially because of what I do for a living, is to say to people, there's no such thing as a marketing expert.
Yes.
And then, and you know, because, you know, people, I obviously, you know, market myself as a marketing expert. You know, if you walk into a room and say, there's no such thing as a marketing expert, people look at you like you're crazy. You've come in as a marketing expert. Now you're saying they don't exist. And I always say, because it's the most dangerous thing you can do, because the word marketing comes from understanding the market. And to think that you instinctively understand the market is the most dangerous thing you can do, because you start to make assumptions and you're always learning. because markets that you've worked in for years, markets shift, markets change, trends change, cultures change. If it's a marketplace that you haven't worked in before, even more so. And so you have to get into the mindset as a marketer that you're always learning. You're always learning, and your job is to learn. Your job is to understand your customer. And what you said, Douglas, is 100% right. Don't ask them what they need, because if you ask them what they need, they'll tell you what they think the solution is, and they don't know what the solution is. What you want to understand is their universe, their challenges, their dreams, their hopes, their desires, their goals. You want to understand their ecosystem, you know, everything that that motivates them, that drives them, that keeps them awake at night, that challenges them. And then you can start to think about what the solutions may look like. But asking them for the solution is patently ridiculous. The Henry Ford quote is a great quote, and it's true. He said that, you know, if I'd asked them what they wanted, they'd have said a faster horse. But what he did understand was that the horse had its limitations, that it got tired, that they had to keep stopping, that it was expensive to keep, it was expensive to feed. And if you can understand those challenges, what are the alternative solutions? You know, one of the examples I give is Steve Jobs. If he'd said to people, you know, would you like an iPad? They'd have said no. And in fact, in all the market research, everybody said they didn't want an iPad because they didn't want a third device, which was, of course, true. But the only thing is, they didn't dump the iPad, they dumped their laptop. Because Steve Jobs understood the challenge that he was solving. And the challenge that he was solving for his customers was that as media started to migrate online, a laptop computer was a horrible device to watch TV on and read magazines and newspapers on. And so he wanted to create a device that was more akin to doing those things, because he could see a world where media was migrating online. So he understood the challenge and he came up with a solution. All he had to understand from his customers was the challenge. And customers could say, yeah, you know, reading a newspaper on my computer is horrible. It's clunky. It doesn't feel natural, you know. So it's about understanding your customer's universe, and you can never know enough. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, you always say, it's an old quote, but you don't learn about lions from going to the zoo. You learn about lions from going to the jungle. So, you know, if you want to understand your customers, go and see them in their environment. You know, if you're a retailer, go and watch them look at your products in retail stores, where they actually interact with those products. Go and look at your customers in the jungle, where they're trying to achieve what they want to achieve. And the problem is, too many companies are trying to run their businesses by staying in their office. They don't go out and meet their customers. They don't go out and meet their customers in their own environment. And you can't run a business like that. You know, I always say to people, business is a contact sport. Get out there and make contact with the customers. Meet them, speak to them, understand them, and do it in their environment, not in yours. And then you've got a fighting chance of coming up with something relevant.
Mm. Find the friction in your customer's life, and you can pull on that thread. That's great about get out of the zoo and get into the jungle. And there have been so many great books on the show that have talked about how you just have to go and observe them. You have to spend time with them.
Yes.
I just want to quote here. You say, the best marketers are not under the illusion that they are experts or that they innately understand their customer. Rather, they assume they know nothing, separate their own opinions and preferences from those of their customer, and then go and find out. So, Grant, I just wanted to end with some controversy.
Yes.
Number 26. Yes. You're a brave person. Every business requires a, quote, higher purpose. You know, and I have to be honest, when I have seen this discussed in various books, and it's an interesting concept, I'm not always able to connect the dots, because it just seemed to me like, I don't know. I mean, there are some companies with higher purposes that are really laudable. But then you have finally made me feel like I'm not such an idiot, because I didn't completely believe it. Explain what you mean when you say, you know, not, and I don't know if Simon Sinek is listening, but explain what you mean. And he's got great books and he's a great author, but it was his book, Start With Why, that got a lot of people headed down this route. Explain, I don't know. Is it okay not to have a higher purpose if it just doesn't make sense?
Yeah, 100%. So let's start at the beginning, right? You have to follow the data. So this idea that in order to be successful as a business, you need to have a higher purpose is a myth, because it's just not true. I know myself, and many others will. I know successful businesses. I know businesses that I've worked with that are turning over millions of dollars a year and are very successful at what they do, and they don't have a higher purpose.
Could that be like Amazon?
100%. Amazon is a great example. Their mission is to be the Earth's most customer-centric company, where customers can find and discover anything that they may want to buy online, and you know, and offer the lowest prices. But that's not why they're in business. That's not their why. That's what they actually deliver, and they're one of the most successful companies on the planet, as we know. So there are plenty of companies that. Now, this isn't binary. That doesn't mean that no company should have a why. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that this myth that every company needs a why in order to be successful is just not true, because I can show you companies, you just mentioned one, Amazon, which doesn't have a higher purpose that's apparent and is incredibly successful. And I would say that most sales-led businesses, in other words, people buy the person, not the brand, because they don't have a brand, don't need a higher purpose. My electrician doesn't need a higher purpose. I use my electrician because he was recommended to me by someone else. He's meant to be very good at what he does. He's never let me down. I've never asked my electrician when he's come to my house what his higher purpose is. Similarly, my accountant doesn't need a higher purpose, because I didn't buy a brand. I bought a human being. And that human being is just a person-to-person connection. I bought the person. He's always done a good job for me. And we've stayed, you know, he stayed my accountant ever since. So first of all, a higher purpose really is only relevant to a brand anyway. And actually, you know, many businesses are really selling their own personal reputation rather than some sort of higher brand. So it's only bigger businesses. But then there are lots and lots of bigger businesses where the higher purpose is just irrelevant. You know, my favorite one is Uber, because Uber's declared higher purpose is to ignite opportunity by setting the world in motion. Well, you know, if I said to most people when they use their Uber app, are you using that Uber app because Uber want to set the world in motion? They just look at me like I'm an idiot. They'd say to me, no, I'm using the Uber app because it's really convenient and really easy. And I don't have any cash on me. And they've got my car details and I can track when it comes. It's just super convenient. And that's fine. So in other words, most people buy Uber because of what they do, not why they do it. And that's all right. That's not to negate, as you said, Douglas, in your question, that some companies have an incredible why and it's incredibly powerful and it does very, very well. You know, in the book, I cite Microsoft, who in 1977, Bill Gates and Paul Allen wanted to put a computer on every desk and in every home. That was a laudable mission, which they managed to deliver on. And that was amazing. And so there are companies with a why that works, but this idea that I cannot be a good and successful company without a why, I just think is silly, and I think it gets in certain businesses' way.
Yes, and again, I may be the only one, but sometimes when I'm hearing about that, there's a little bit of an aftertaste of you're a bad company if you're not, you know, you're somehow less than honorable or whatever. But the only other question I have is that when you know, live in Bushy, as you do, are your electrician and your accountant, are they 1980s former rock stars as well?
Well, that's a good question. I think actually there's a lot of wannabe musicians, so they could well be wannabe pop stars. They weren't actual pop stars, but wannabe pop stars is quite possible. I will make sure I ask them next time they're around.
Yeah, if you could do that, check on that, let me know. I'd appreciate it. So, Grant, if readers took only one thing away from this book, what would you hope it would be?
I would hope that they took away a deeper understanding of what marketing is and how it can help their business. Because the mission that I was on when I wrote this book, and actually it's something that drives me, is I see businesses that are that either fail or are not as successful as they could be because they don't understand how marketing can deliver value for them. And I think just an understanding of what marketing can actually do for a business, and it isn't just a bit of comms, can make all the difference to business success. And if someone just reads the book and takes that away and just, I've got a bit more of an understanding of what marketing can do for me, I think for personally, that will be a great takeaway.
I don't know, Grant Leboff. That sounds like a higher purpose to me. No, I'm kidding. No, it's very true. And I think this would be a great book to give to maybe prospects or companies that are, or there's a lot of, there's this term I use sometimes called thrusters, that people who are listening to this podcast, I think they've been suddenly thrust into a marketing role. In other words, yes. They might have, like my friend Frank, who suddenly became CEO of this company, and he was just like, he was an engineer. Well, this is something I've had to deal with in my entire career. Or let's say somebody was been in charge of sales, had a very successful sales career, and they've suddenly put the word marketing on their business card now. And so this is the book can help enormously of helping somebody make heads or tails. Maybe I got more excited just because I have seen so many of these myths and how much destruction. They continue to cause. So is there one thing you can think of a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from your book?
Yeah, you know what? I think this is really relevant right now because we're living in such an uncertain world. I think that go back and understand that marketing is about determining value. It's about creating a customer. Just go back and look at your value proposition. Is it spot on? Is it 100% relevant? Is this something that I could do to just tweak it, change it slightly to make it even more relevant, even more exciting for the audience that I'm addressing? I think just revisiting that value proposition, and maybe you can carve it up a bit, cut it up a bit, change it slightly. I think people don't experiment enough. And sometimes experimentation can lead to great things.
That's great advice. And what I'm going to do in your episode's blog post or website page at marketingbookpodcast.com, I'm going to include a link to an interview I did with an author, one of your fellow UK residents, Malcolm McDonald. He wrote a book. He's written between 40 and 50 books. His book is on value propositions. Great one to listen to for people that want to get better acquainted with value propositions. So, Grant, this is a question I ask first-time guests. So if you come back, you're going to be able to opt out of this question. What books have most inspired your work and career?
Well, that's a great question. I think that – so I've read a lot of books on behavioral economics, mm-hmm. which I think people don't know enough about, you know, in marketing, which I think people should think more about. So any books on behavioral economics, there's quite a few. But I suppose from a marketing perspective, you didn't strictly ask that, but from a marketing
because you could talk about the music industry if you like.
But from a marketing perspective, I would probably say positioning.
Yes,
I think that is a fantastic book by Al Rees and Jack Trout.
Yes, positioning, the battle for your mind, and you mentioned it in this. We didn't get to that part. I apologize.
And I suppose the only other one that I would implore all marketers to read, it's a slightly tougher book than Positioning, is Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman.
Yes, that book has been mentioned many times by other authors on the Marketing Book Podcast. And, you know, I think back to Positioning, that may have been one of the very first marketing books I ever read. It's still so very relevant. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or have heard of that you're looking forward to either reading or seeing come out?
So a more recent book, forgive me, I'm not sure how recent it is, but there's a book, I don't know if your listeners know, called The Choice Factory by a guy called Richard Shotton. Mm-hmm. It's 25 behavioral biases that influence what we buy. And I think for a marketer, it's really revealing about how customers think, and it's about getting back inside your customer's mind. And it's only a few years old, maybe a couple of years old, maybe something like that. But mm-hmm. I would, if people haven't heard of that book before, I would highly recommend that.
Well, we'll make sure to include a link to that book at marketingbookpodcast.com. We're going to include links to everything linkable, okay? Just for you, listener. It's going to be Sticky Marketing Club and Grant's LinkedIn profile, and so that folks can reach out to you and thank you for being on the podcast. It just to the listener, I'd like to say the authors really enjoy it when they hear from people that listen to this interview, because it was really hard getting Grant on the show because he figured I'd be the only one listening to this this interview. I'm kidding. I'm a kidder. But for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is Myths of Marketing: Banish the Misconceptions and Become a Great Marketer. The author is Grant Leboff. Grant, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Douglas.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, I would like to return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I will drop it in the mail to you. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on this show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.